This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Rebbeinu Shlomo entails Avora, if he's going to have a child by Sarah. Aval Sarah Yishlecho Yoledes Lecho Ben, Sarah's wife will give birth to a son for you. Ekoretho Eshmo Yitzchok, and you shall call his name Yitzchok. And Rashi brings two views as to why his name was Yitzchok. He was to be Yitzchok. First, Hashem Atzchok,
as a result of the laughter.
For a few psukim earlier, Avraham had been told that he was going to have a child. Now you pay Avraham atono vayitzchok, and Avraham fell on his face and he laughed.
That was amazing,
and it gave him an enormous sense of joy to the point that he actually broke out in laughter.
And as a result of that
laughter, where he said in his heart, "Halavim mea shomer yivanu,
and so habastishim
shomer tzedet," is it possible that a man of 100 years old
will have a child,
and Sarah, who is 90 years old, will give birth to a child?
And because of that tzchok,
Yitzchok's name was to become Yitzchok.
That's the one of you.
The Rosh Hashem, al shem ha'asor nisyonis, and some say it's because of the 10
trials
which Avraham, the 10 challenges to which Avraham was subjected, the tishim shana shel Sarah,
and the 90 years of Sarah, the Shmuel Rami Shemina, in the 8th day in which Yitzchok had his birth, the Kut Shema Shel Avraham, and the hundred years of Avraham. That's in chapter 17, verse 19. I think you're going to finish it, taking it seriously. 17:19 in the Rashi. Rashi brings these two views. Firstly, the word tzochak, laughter, appears in the Torah 11 times in different forms. 7 of them are related to Yitzchok. So this is not the only time that there's laughter in relationship to Yitzchok. Yitzchok, this laughter theme comes on over and over again in connection with Yitzchok. Here is the first case. Later on, Sarah laughs. She denies having laughed. The Rebbeinu Shlomo says, "You did laugh." You'll remember later on, Sarah catches Yishmael mocking and laughing and insists that he be expelled at that time. This theme of laughter comes over and over again. And there are two types of laughter. There is the laughter of joy, as Rashi says a little earlier, when Avraham fell on his face and he laughed in Pasuk 17, this laughter inklus translates as joy. The shel sorrow loshen mochuch, and the laughter of sorrow next week said he translates as mochuch, as smiling, as smirking, as more of a mockery type of laughter, more of a cynical type of laughter. So we see that the theme involves two types of laughter. There's Avraham's laughter, which is one of joy. And there's Sarah's laughter, which is one of disbelief, of cynicism. Later on, Yishmael's laughter again is one of cynicism. Sarah says, "Whoever hears about this birth is going to laugh at me." What does that mean? Laugh at me or laugh with me? Will they be mocking or will they be joyous with me? But this double theme of tzchok comes right through over and again with regard to the birth of Yitzchok. We need to try and understand a little bit of that. And secondly, the second view that Rashi brings, that Yitzchok's name is based on the Yud for 10, the 10 trials, the Tzadi is for 90, the 90 years of Sorrow, the Ches is the 8 days of the Milah, and the Kuf, the 100, is the 100 years of Avraham Avinu. That's very nice and pretty. But is it just coincidental that those words spell out Yitzchok, and that only 3 psukim earlier were told that Avraham laughed, and that the laughter theme comes over and over again with Yitzchok, according to the second view? Are we going to say that that's all it is, that his name was Yitzchok, and it had nothing to do with the root tzochak, but it had nothing to do with laughter?
So we probably have to say that there's a combination of both of these, and in fact there is a Gersa in Rashi that doesn't say the Yosh Emin, there's another Gersa that says Ve'al Shem Asor Emishyus, and additionally, in addition to the Tzchok theme, there's another theme in the name of Yitzchok, and that is the 10, 90, 8, and 100 theme. Which means there must be a connection between not only those four, not only the four figures, the 10, the 8, the 90, and the 100, there must be some kind of connection between the 10 trials, the 10 challenges, and the 8th day of Milo, and the 90 years of Sora, and the 100 years of Avram. Those four must all be connected, but furthermore, those four must be connected with the theme of Tzchok, with the theme of laughter. And that's what we need to analyze too. In order to do so, I want to summarize the idea that I developed in last night's year. Three names are created in the Seder. The name of Avraham, which used to be Avram, he's given a new name, Avraham. The name Sora, she used to be Sorai, and now she's Sora. And the name of Yitzchak. These three names are all created. The name of Avraham. What was it that brought about the change in the name of Avraham? So if we look at the sequence of events, what happened was his milo, Avraham has a bris, and the mitzvah of bris is given to Avraham, and then he is told that his name is going to, first he has his bris, then his name is changed from Avraham to Avraham, and then he's given the mitzvah of bris ledoros, that every generation children need to have a bris milah on the eighth day. The lo yikorei oid eshimcho Avraham, this is in chapter 17 verse 5, and his name will no longer be called, your name will no longer be called Avraham, v'hoyo shimcho Avraham, your name will now be Avraham, ki av hamoin goyin nesaticho, for I have made you into the father of multitudes of nations. And what were you until now? What does this mean, I've made you into a father? Firstly, what does it mean that you're the father of nations? Adam was the father of nations. We discussed that already. But Avraham was not the father of nations, he was the father only of the Jewish people. What's the Hamoin Goyim? And secondly, what was he before? What is the change which came upon him? Says Rashi, Ki av Hamoin Goyim, Roshin Mutrikun, this is a compressed Shel Shemoi, his name is a compression of the statement. Av Hamoin Goyim, so the Av Aleph Beis from Av, and Hamoin, the He and the Mem of Hamoin joined together, and that makes Avham, which is what his name should have been. But his name is Avraham, the Reish that was there before remains, says Rashi. The Reish Hosa Berbit Chilo, and the reason that the Reish was there is because it was there before. Because until now he was the father only of Aram. That was his place. And he was the father there. So up till now his name meant Avram, the father of Aram. Now he's been made Avham. But we're not going to diminish his name, and we're not going to merely substitute letters, we're going to add letters. He's being expanded. It's not just a change of letters. The Reish remains where it was. He's the father of Aram as he used to be. But in addition to that, he is also Avham, Avhamoin Goyim, he is also the father of many nations. What does that mean, that he is the father of many nations? And what is the change? We explained last night that Rashi points out that he was the father of Aram, in what sense? Shehu Mekome, because that was his place. And now he's an Av L'chol Ha'ilam, for the entire world. Avraham Avinu was the father, not only of Aram where he lived, and not only of Eretz Canaan where he lived later on, and not only of that little area of the cradle of civilization, but he was the Av of the entire world. Of every country in the world, no matter how far, no matter how distant, no matter how foreign, Avraham was considered to be the father of multitudes of nations throughout the entire universe, throughout the entire world. And the change we discussed last night was not a quantitative change. It was not merely a matter of additional children being added to the family of Avraham. whereas he used to be the father of one nation consisting of X million people, he's now the father of countless nations, and he's the father of millions and millions of people. That's not what it means. Av Hamein Goyim, this change is a change in quality. For beforehand he was the father of his place, and now he's the father of the entire world. What is an Av? What does a father mean? First thing that a father means is one who recreates out of himself, or creates out of himself. Some people don't create at all. Some people create but not out of themselves. And some people create out of themselves. When one is taking oneself and creating from within oneself, that's considered an Av. One is producing a Torah, one is producing a generation, something which has been born out of oneself. That is what an Av is. There are two types of Av. And this we related back to the Gemara in the beginning of Bava Kamma, where the Gemara discusses in halachic terms, where the term Av is used as well. So Av, a father, is used biologically. Av is used socially. There's a father is a biological relationship. It's also a social relationship, a sociological relationship. But it's also a halachic relationship. The Gemara gives two examples. The one example is in the laws of Shabbos. The laws of Shabbos, we have what we call an Av Melacha. An Av Melacha is a head of a category of Melacha, which is those principal actions which are prohibited on Shabbos. They're called Av Melachas. Well, how do we know that they're prohibited? Anything which used to be, any action, any creative action which used to take place in the Mishkan, in the construction of the Mishkan and in the maintenance of the Mishkan, any such action is called an Av Melacha. That's something which has its source in the Torah and is not permitted. What happens if there's another action which didn't take place in the Mishkan? But it's exactly the same. The concept is exactly the same. For example, we're dealing on Monday nights with the laws of Livun. So in the Mishkan they used to bleach. And that's the Av Melacha, to bleach. What happens if you don't bleach, you remove a stain? Without bleaching, by laundering you remove a stain. What is that? The effect is exactly the same. You've removed the stain. Therefore, the issue is the same. It's as prohibited as bleaching. But that's called a toldo. It's not called an av. Because it's not specifically mentioned in the Torah. Laundering as such is not mentioned in the Torah. Bleaching is not laundering. How do we figure out that laundering is not allowed? Because we analyze the essential properties and qualities of the av melocha of bleaching. And we compare and we say this is exactly the same. So we, through our intellectual analysis, have created an Isu Shabbos through our understanding of the Av Melacha. The Av Melacha, that primary category called bleaching, has conceptually created a child. Laundering is not mentioned in the Torah, and yet we have been able to conceptually give birth to the concept of laundering as being equally prohibited, although it's not mentioned in the Torah because its father is in the Torah and its father had a child. The toldo is the laundering. That's a conceptual toldo, where we use our minds to give birth to a concept out of a primary concept. Now, there's another kind of a toldo that the Gemara discusses, and that's the toldo of tumah. For example, if a person comes into contact with a dead body, he becomes what we call an av hatumah. An av hatumah is a father of tumor. What does a father of tumor mean? Tumor is defilement, is a spiritual impurity. What does it mean he's a father of tumor? That means he can create more tumor. That's what an av means. So if he in turn touches something else, that becomes a rishon l'tumah, that becomes affected, and it also becomes tumah. How did it become tumah? Because an av tumor came into contact with the second object. And so although there wasn't tumor before, the tumor has spread. Something new has become tome. Something which before used to be pure, used to be clean, used to be tohor, is now no longer tohor. Why did it come into contact with the dead body? No, but the ava tumor created from within itself. It created a secondary tier of tumor. That is the power of tumor, that it can be transferred from one tier to the next. And an ava tumor is the source of tumor which can transmit itself and create itself in other objects around and about it. It's a different kind of Av. That's a different kind of father. A different kind of relationship. Here, what is the difference? In the case of Shabbos, Our tables were created not from any kind of physical contact. The Av was in the Mishkan 3,500 years ago, and the Toldo could be created in Johannesburg today. We can create a new Toldo. If we understand the principles of the Av, we can take a new technological invention or process or procedure which didn't exist before, and we can decide whether it is part of the Av Melacha or not. For example, if one prints out on a computer screen, is that writing or isn't it writing? Does that form part of the Melacha? Does that form part of the Issur of writing? So we would say, we would analyze it and we would figure out, and if the poskim felt that it sufficiently resembled the original, then we would say yes, although there were no computer screens in those days, and although till very recently this whole concept didn't exist, it doesn't matter. Although there are centuries and millennia between the source and the Toldo, the poskim might well decide this is a Toldo of writing, this is a form of writing, and therefore it forms part of the Issur d'oraisa, it's part of the prohibition of the Torah, but it's not the Av, it's not the source. The source is the kind of writing they used to do in the Mishkan, that's the Av, that's the father. But that father can regenerate all sorts of other Issurim which have the same properties as itself, it can reproduce itself in all sorts of forms, and there doesn't have to be physical proximity. All there has to be is conceptual proximity, and from the conceptual proximity there can be created a Toldo. Not so with Tumah. A father of Tumah can only give birth to a Toldo if there is physical proximity. It cannot travel conceptually. There has to be physical contact. And if there's physical, that's why a Kohen has to be careful. What does the Kohen have to be careful about? Not whether he thinks about Tumah or not. He can't become Tomei through concepts. That's not that type of Tumah. He has to be careful where he goes, that he doesn't go into a house in which there's a dead body, that he doesn't walk near graves on a cemetery. So he'll be careful with the degree of contact. And if he's more than 4 amos away from the grave, he's okay. The tumor won't affect him, even though he's there and he's in the midst of the cemetery and he's surrounded by graves. Doesn't matter. It's too far. There's not sufficient physical proximity for the tumor to be transferred from the grave to the person. There has to be physical proximity. And the Gemara that we're learning in the beginning of Bava Kamma discusses these different concepts of Av, how we see in Halacha that the concept of an Av can be developed along two completely different tangents. Either a conceptual region or a conceptual generation of Toldos, or a physical generation of Toldos. What about Avraham Avinu? Rashi tells us that until this stage, he was the father of Aram, Shehu Mekoinu, that was his place. So we see that his father relationship was one that required physical proximity. He was able to influence, he was able to create Talmidim, he was able to generate other people to think as himself, to believe as himself. But for him to affect his environment, it had to be a physical environment. It had to be people with whom he had contact. He only had influence over his environment, over his place. He couldn't influence beyond his place. Whereas after the change of name, the Achshav Av L'chol Ha'ilam, how can one man influence the whole world? How is it possible? There wasn't television then. There wasn't radio. The media didn't exist. How could one man sitting in Aram or in Eretz Yisrael later on, how could he influence the whole world? How could he be an Av Hamoin Goyim? He didn't give birth to them physically. He didn't even have contact with them. He didn't teach them. He didn't see them. He didn't know them. And yet he's called Av Hamoin Goyim. In what way is he an Av? Now he changes from the Av of the Tumah concept of Av to the Shabbos concept of Av, where he's influencing people conceptually, and there doesn't have to be physical contact for that. There are many examples that one can do of that. The one example is it happens very often. You find in the Shulchan Aruch, for example, that Taz, in analyzing a piece of Shulchan Aruch, emerges with an enormous chidush. And he explains the Shulchan Aruch in a way that has never been explained before. And he says at the end of the passage, I was concerned with the originality of this piece, and so I discussed it with my colleagues and with my rabbein, and they were very impressed, and they accepted that this was a good pshat. And then you read the Shach, who was a little while later, and just in passing, he says the same thing. And people often ask, it's such a big chiddush, where does the Shach get it from, and why doesn't the Shach make the same tool? Why doesn't he get equally excited? Once a concept has been created, it is explained and it exists in the world. And once it exists in the world, other people can hack it without great difficulty. The art is to bring it into the world, to conceive of it, to give birth to the concept. Then other people, one finds in all areas of human knowledge, you'll very often find questions as to who was the originator of something. Somebody originated something, it's a big chiddush, and then one finds that somebody else who couldn't have had any contact with him and couldn't have had any access to his work develops the same concept. In physics one has it, in all sorts of areas. Once the concept has been created, its effect is universal. And there doesn't have to be physical contact in order for it to have effect. The Shach did not have to fear the Taz's chiddush in order to be able to do it himself. That wasn't necessary. Once the idea had been created, to the Shach it came naturally and it came automatically. Where did it come from? It came from the Taz. Did the Shach hear it from the Taz? No. Did the Shach know that it came from the Taz? No. Did the Shach read it in the Taz? No, he didn't have access to it at that time. And so we see that when a Torah is created conceptually, its influence exceeds any barriers of time and space. When a Torah is created physically, it is bound by physical limitations, and it can only be transmitted by physical proximity. But when a Torah is created conceptually, it is not bound and limited by anything at all, and it can be transmitted universally, instantaneously. There is no difficulty, there is no problem with it. We begin to see that even in science, even in nature, the different types of waves. You've got sound waves which need physical proximity. That's physical movement. Particles are moving backwards and forwards, and they get weaker and weaker as the distance goes, and you can only hear it a certain distance, and then the sound wave fizzles out. But there are energy waves, there are electromagnetic waves, which aren't physical objects moving backwards and forwards. It's not the same concept. It's far more of a conceptual transmission. And that can be limitless. You can send messages, you can communicate with outer space, and you can receive messages from outer space. From light years away, these things can travel. How come? So far, it's a different concept. Sometimes we influence each other by physical contact. Sometimes we need to be seen, we need to be heard, we need to be felt, our presence needs to be felt. And sometimes we influence each other, I suppose they call it subconsciously, whatever term you want to give it. But we're able to influence each other's ideas merely by the creation of new ideas, by the bringing of new ideas from their potential into actuality. We are able to influence the world, we're able to affect the world. And this really is explained or expressed very beautifully in the Mesillas Yeshayim when he discusses the difference between the Tohor and the Kodesh. And he says, "V'hineho ish ha-miskadesh b'kedushas boiroi," a person who is sanctified with the sanctity of his Creator, "afilu ma'asov ha-gashmiyim choizrim li'yeis inyonei kedusho mamash," even his physical activities become essentially sanctified. He doesn't do anything physical. All the physical things he does become holy. The simoncho achilas kodshim shehi atzme mitzvah aser. For example, when the Kohanim eat kodshim, that's a mitzvah aser, that's a positive mitzvah. Although they're eating, there's nothing really so physical and material as eating, and yet in the case of achilas kodshim, of the eating of the korbanos, that's a mitzvah aser. The tire ato ha'hefer shebein ha'toru lekodesh. And now you will perceive the difference between the Torah, the pure man, and the Kodesh, the holy man. The Torah, his physical activities, he has to do. He only does what he has to do. He doesn't do anything which isn't absolutely necessary. He will eat only as much as he needs to eat. And he will do business only as much as he needs in order to survive. And he will speak to people outside of Torah only as much as he needs to speak in order to do what needs to be done. Nothing extra, nothing more than that. And his intention in doing this is only because he needs to do this in order to keep going. And as a result of this, his physical actions, while they remain physical, rid themselves of anything negative. They are physical actions which are entirely positive and pure. But he has not elevated those actions into Kedusha. They still exist, they are material, they remain material, but they have purity, they have tahara. Because if he could manage without them, he would prefer it. But this person who is holy, who always keeps to the Ribbono Shel Olam, that's a different thing altogether. It's as if he's actually walking with the Ribbono Shel Olam while he still stands here on this world. This man changes himself into a different being. He himself is considered like the Mishkan, like the Beis HaMikdash, like the Mizbeach, and everything he does ceases to be material. When one brings an animal onto the Mizbeach and one sacrifices the animal, is there anything material in that action? Although you're using material things, it's not a material activity at all. It's the pinnacle of spiritual activity. So everything that the Ish Kodesh does, everything the holy man does, is in fact absolutely spiritual. And so on, that there's an absolute blending between such a person and the Ribbono Shel Olam himself. So the terms used to describe these two different peoples are the Tohu and the Kodesh. The Tohu still is involved in physical things, but his physical things are pure. The Kodesh is not really involved in anything physical, because everything physical he does is in fact spiritualized. It has been elevated to something spiritual. It's interesting, the two terms. Tohu, the physical one, relates to the Av in Tumo. When we're dealing with Tumo and Taharo, there needs to be physical proximity, because the concept of Tumo and Taharo are physical concepts. There's spiritual dimensions of physical concepts. But when you're dealing with Kedusha, that's entirely sanctified, that's entirely Kodesh, that's entirely holy. There is no physical dimension to it at all. And Shabbos, we talk about Kedusha as Shabbos. Shabbos Kodesh, when we talk about Shabbos, it's a different concept altogether. So the Gemara in Bava Kamma, when it analyzes the Ovis of Tumo and the Ovis of Shabbos, the Ovis of Tumo are the Ovis of the physical type of generation, and the Ovis of Shabbos are the spiritual type of generation. Now what was Avraham? Was Avraham a Tohu or was Avraham a Kodesh? Was Avraham living a spiritual life, a physical life, but totally dedicated to things spiritual? Or was he not even living a physical life? Was he operating on a spiritual level? One of the ways we can examine is, how was his method of influence? If he influenced people through contact with them, then he must have been living a physical life. If he was unable to influence people with whom he had no contact, then he was occupied in physical relationships. Very special physical relationships. Physical relationships that were involved with pure Taro. There was absolute purity. There was nothing in them that wasn't pure. But the relationships remained physical. If, however, he was able to influence people far beyond his immediate environment, he was able to influence people and to have an effect on nations that were far beyond him, and to be creative with nations that were far beyond him, then he's involved in Kedusha. This is something else altogether. Taharo is a sound wave. Taharo can only go a certain distance provided there's physical proximity. Kedusha is an electromagnetic wave that knows no barriers, and its influence and its effect is absolutely universal. That's the change which comes over Avraham. Whereas he used to be Avram, he used to be the father generating in his immediate environment of Olam, he becomes Avram, able to generate toldos, able to generate effects and new creations, b'chol ha'olam kulo, in the entire world. There was nowhere that his influence didn't reach. That was the change. Avram moves from operating in the realm of Tahara into operating in the realm of Kedusha. And how does he do that? He does that with the Bris Milah. The Bris Milah is the human being's development of mastery over nature. The Bris Milah expresses our belief that nature is the starting point, not the ending, not the end point. In most philosophies, the more natural people are, the more they're reaching higher levels. Not so in Torah. In Torah, nature is just the starting point. Nature is what animals are. To become a human being, we have to become supernatural. We have to take nature and we have to work and create out of nature. That's what the Bris Milah is. The child is born the way nature wants the child to be born. We come along and we say, not good enough. The Torah wants a change to nature. And the Bris Milah is man's domination over nature. We will change ourselves. We will achieve perfection, not through being the way nature perfected us, but by being the way we perfect nature. And we take ourselves and improve ourselves further, and that's expressed by the Bris Milah, which is on the eighth day. And eighth is always the one up. Seven is a complete cycle. The seven notes in an octave, and the eighth one is the next one up. The 7 days in the week, and the eighth one is the next day, is the next one up already. And so it is with the Bris Milah. Seven is natural. That's the way we were created. A whole week goes by. That's normal. Now comes the eighth day, and we elevate the child into a completely different level. This is no longer nature. We're now giving a dimension of height, and we're uplifting the child into a new realm and launching him into a new type of lifestyle. And so after Avraham Avinu has his Bris Milah, then the Ribbono Shel Olam is able to say, now you're no longer Avraham. Now you are Avraham. You have become a person who is not only perfected nature, but you have mastered nature, you have dominated nature. There is no more nature with you. You're supernatural. You're operating in the area of Kedusha, and therefore your influence is universal. Your influence is no longer limited by physical boundaries and by physical dimensions. That's the concept that we developed last night. Why does Avraham take 100 years to get to the Bris Milah stage? And from Yitzchak and onwards it takes 8 days. What took 100 years to get there? Why did the Ribbono Shel Olam not tell him a long time ago to have his Bris Milah? So we must say Avraham had to work it all himself. Avraham was the first person, and he was born naturally like anybody else. And he had to acquire within himself the elevated state of being supernatural. Up until then, through the 100 years, he was working within the realm of nature, becoming more and more perfect, but still natural. After this, Avraham Avinu becomes a Kodesh. After this, Avraham Avinu elevates himself to a situation where there's no longer anything natural at all about him. He's operating on an entirely different level. He's not bound by the laws of physics anymore. He now controls the laws of physics. He masters the laws of physics. He's a master not only of himself, but he's an Av Hamoyim Goyim. He becomes a master of nations throughout the world. He influences the world throughout. That's something that Avraham achieves. Yitzchak is born with that. Yitzchak is born with the capacity to overcome his nature. How come he's born with it? Why is that? That's unfair. Why does he get such a head start? That's a bane. You remember our discussion on what a son is? A son starts where the father left off. The son gives the child everything that the father worked for. The father gives the son everything that the father worked for. This is a midah which Avraham took 100 years of his life to develop. And he's able to give it, to instill it. He has acquired it so much that it becomes so much part of him that his genes change, that his whole essence changes. And now anybody born from the seed of Avraham Avinu throughout the generations is born with that head start, is born with that capacity of being able to have a Bris Milah. Immediately they're born. What does the Bris Milah show? I can master nature. You can, a little 8-year-old baby, you can master nature? Yes, because I'm born with that capacity. I was given that gene by my Zayda Avraham Avinu. And that's why we call him Avraham Avinu, because we have his properties. Everything that he developed within himself, he is given, he is inherited to us, and we have that. That's why he's Avraham Avinu. There's a beautiful question that the Reb Chaim Volozhiner asks on the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, in the fifth Perek. Mishnah Beis, I think it is, says Asora Doris Minoach Vad Avraham. There were 10 generations from Noach to Avraham. Counts the generations and talks about it. The next Mishnah says Asora Nisyonis Niso Avraham Avinu. Avraham, our father, was tried with 10 trials, with 10 challenges. Asks Reb Chaim Volozhiner, why doesn't the first one also call him Avinu? Asora Doris Minoach Ad Avraham Avinu, it should say, or it should leave Avinu out throughout. Says Reb Chaim Volozhiner, there's no, Avinu is a relationship. Counting generations from Noach to Avraham has nothing to do with us. But the 10 nisyonos, for that is Avinu. Because those 10 challenges, those 10 trials which Avraham was able to successfully master, became part of him, and he inherited them to us. And we naturally have within us to do all the things that Avraham had to struggle so much for to be able to do in those 10, in those 10 examples. As Reb Chaim Volozhiner says, for example, a Jew will give his life for his Yiddishkeit. You find sometimes even Jews who far, who distant, who in their lifetime didn't live Yiddishkeit. But if a guy will come and say, you either give up your religion or I kill you, you'll have many, many Jews who were far, far from Yiddishkeit all their lives will say, you kill me, I won't give it up. Where does that come from, asks Reb Chaim Volozhiner.
Does it come from their environment? Can't be. Does it come from their education? Can't be. Does it come from their family? Can't be. That comes from Avraham Avinu when he was willing to throw himself into the fire. That's where it comes from. That nisoyon is something which every Jew has within himself. But Chaim Volozhin says something else which is important to know. The midah of Zionism, he regards it as a kind of a midah, a Jewish characteristic. People willing to give their lives for a country, for Eretz Yisrael, a country which doesn't really have any real political or economic way of existing. It's a dream, it's a crazy idea that the Jews should be able to form themselves into a nation in Israel, that little land that has no natural resources, that is totally dependent on its entire environment, and yet people are willing to give their lives to go to Eretz Israel, to fight for Eretz Israel, to be miyashiv Eretz Israel, to go and live in Eretz Israel in hardship. Why would people do such a thing? People leave, as Ivan said this morning in his Dvar Torah, people leave sometimes because they're very unhappy where they are, and it doesn't make any difference where they go. They leave sometimes because they're happy where they are, but they've got a wonderful opportunity somewhere else. But to Eretz Israel, you find people leaving, they're happy where they are, and they're going to nothing, and yet they go. Says Reb Chaim Volozhin, that's from Lech Lecho, that's from Avraham Avinu. That middle of being able to move away from the position of comfort and to go to Eretz Yisrael with all the sacrifice that it involved, Avraham Avinu acquired that middle and he was moirish it to his children, he gave it to his children. And that's why the Mishnah says, Asor nisyonis niso Avraham Avinu. Avraham, our father, was tried with those 10 challenges and he inherited them to us. We have them today as a result of that. That's why it's Avinu. And so Yitzchok is able to have his bismillah immediately. And from then onwards, every Jewish baby is able to have his bismillah immediately. Because he has within him the genes that will make it possible for him to master nature. Every Jew has that within him. What about the 10th trial, which has not yet taken place? That's mentioned in Yitzchok's name. Now this idea that Yitzchok's name is made up of these four letters is a little bit strange, because what are they? Two of them are in the past and two of them in the future. Yitzchok has not yet been born. So the Tzadi and the Kuf, the 90 and the 100, that's the past. Avraham and Sarah are already 90 and 100 years old. The 8th day of the Bris is for the baby that is not yet born, that's in the future. The 10 Nisyonos, and particularly the 10th Nisoyon, which is the one that affects Yitzchok, has not yet taken place. It's going to take place in 37 years' time. So two of the letters of Yitzchok's name are in the future and two are in the past. Is the letter contained of experiences which Yitzchok is to have, or of experiences which his parents had? And yet really, Avraham is already ready for that 10th trial. Once Avraham becomes a Kodosh, once Avraham moves from the physical realm to the spiritual realm, then he's really ready for that trial as well. What is the 10th trial and why is it so important? You might remember on Rosh Hashanah we discussed the fact that when Nimrod threw Avraham Avinu into the furnace of fire, that was no less a trial and tribulation than the Akedah, giving his life, being thrown into a furnace of fire, and there was years of trouble before that. He was tortured for 10 years before he was thrown into the fire. It wasn't just that he was thrown into the fire. And that is not even mentioned in the Torah. There's absolutely no mention of it. And the other Nisyonos are mentioned very by the by, 9 of them, mentioned only very indirectly. Comes the Akedah, and it's given a complete parsha. It's dealt with in vivid detail. We read it every Rosh Hashanah. It's a basic tenet of our belief. We cleave to it, we think of it, we work on it. The Akedah, the near sacrifice of Yitzchak. That 10th trial, which was not necessarily the most severe on the surface, is the one that we make so much to do about, and all the others are virtually ignored by the Torah. But now we can explain that, because the other 9 all took place when Avraham was Avram, not Avraham. And therefore all the other 9 trials took place within the realm of nature. They were very hard. They were very challenging. They were impossibly difficult. We don't understand how difficult they were, because we've got it within us already as a result of Avraham. God comes along and says, Lech lecho me'atzucho me'vorodicho me'besavicha, leave your country and go to Eretz Israel. We say today, what's the big deal? If the Rebbeinu Shlom told any of us to do it, would we hesitate? What's the big deal? many people gave them without the Ribbono Shel Olam telling them. If God said to us clearly, you've got to go to Eretz Yisrael, would it be a challenge for us? Wouldn't be a challenge. There are many people who are sitting in South Africa and waiting. They want God to tell them, emigrate, don't emigrate. They want to hear whatever He tells them they'll do. But for Avraham Avinu, these were enormous challenges, each one of them. But they were all within the realms of nature. Lech lecho, mi'artzecho, mi'beis avicho. What does Hashem tell him? Go and do this. You're a young man. You've got to leave your environment. That's true. It's hard. But ve'eschol lagoy gadol, and I will make you a great nation. Va'avarechecho, va'agadlo shumecho. Ve'yei brocha, I will bless you and make your name great, and you will be a brocha. And Rashi explains that it means that the normal troubles and the normal disadvantages of traveling won't affect you. Everything will be all right. So even from a natural physical point of view, the Ribbono Shel Olam wasn't asking Avraham to do something that goes against nature. He was asking him to do something within the realm of nature that was very challenging and extremely difficult, but still within the realm of nature. Go and climb Mount Everest. Very hard, very difficult. Not everybody can do it. But the reason that everybody can't do it is not because it's impossible within the realms of nature. Not impossible. Go and fly to the moon. Can be done. It's difficult. It's extremely expensive. Not everybody can make it. But it is physically possible to do. Comes the Akedah. This is the first and the only Nisoyan he gets in his role as Avraham. This is after the Avraham stage. Now he's Avraham, and he's being asked to do something which goes against nature. Something which is totally unnatural. All the 9 trials, he was asked to sacrifice everything for his beliefs. Each one of the 9 trials was a different area of sacrifice for the beliefs of Avraham Avinu. And that is natural. One can do something. If one believes strongly enough, one will be willing to sacrifice everything for that in which one truly believes. Otherwise it isn't a true belief. So it's not unnatural for a man with passionate belief to be willing to sacrifice everything in his life for that which he believes is right. But in the case of the Akedah, he was being asked to sacrifice his beliefs for everything. Everything being the Ribbono Shel Olam. To sacrifice your beliefs, that's unnatural. Everything you fought for throughout your life, everything you have sacrificed for, so now you've got to go back and say, for my beliefs I gave up everything. And now I've got to give up my belief. My belief is that you don't sacrifice children, that there are no live sacrifices. That's what I've preached, and that's what I've taught, and that's what I've convinced people. And now the Ribbono Shel Olam is making a mockery of everything I've lived for. To take your beliefs and be willing to sacrifice them too, that's unnatural, that's supernatural. And Avraham has to be tested. But he already qualifies for the test. He needs to wait for Yitzchok to reach his prime, though, before the test can be carried out. And the Ribbono Shel Olam knows full well how that test is going to come out, because Avraham is no longer Avraham. Avraham is Avraham. And Avraham means he's a Kodesh, and if he's a Kodesh, he'll pass the test. The Midrash says, on the word Kach Nois Bin Chol, the Ribbono Shel Olam says, please take your son. Not an instruction, it's a request. Ein no el alashon bakosho. No means it's a request, it's a pleading. And the Midrash says, Kach omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu l'Avraham, harbe nisyonus nisisicho. I have tried you many times, I've challenged you many times. V'amadito b'kulon. And you've stood with them all, you've passed all the tests. B'vakosho mincho, I plead with you, I beg of you. Amoid li b'nisoyon zeh. Just this one too. Pass this test too. So the people won't say the first ones don't count. Why should people say the first ones don't count? Because in all the first ones you can say that was natural. The man had beliefs, he was passionate about his beliefs, he was willing to sacrifice everything for his beliefs. But now we're going to have the test of all tests. This one is going to prove that you did it not just because you believed, but you did it because it was right. And you're going to be called upon to sacrifice your beliefs. That's what's going to have to be done. So Yitzchok is a product of Avraham's reaching the level of Kedusha, of Avraham's reaching a supernatural level. Yitzchok is born, is conceived, after Avraham reaches the stage. And Yitzchok is the fruit of all that effort and all that achievement. Yitzchok becomes the product of Avraham's perfection, of Avraham's Kedusha, expressed in 2 areas. In the 10th challenge, the Akedah, and in the Bris Milah, the fact that Yitzchak at 8 days old can already have the Bris for which Avraham had to wait 100 years. There we see Yitzchok coming into the world as a finished product, as somebody who has all the potential to achieve that which Avram struggled for his entire life.
What about the Ches and the Kuf? What about the Tzadi and the Kuf, the 90 and the 100? We live in a very results-orientated society, where what's important is the results. And a company can tell its shareholders not to worry, we're busy building up a good name for ourselves, and it'll all be okay, and our product is getting wide acceptance, and the shareholders want to know, but why are we making a loss? What's the bottom line? What are the dividends going to be this year? And they're not interested in what's happening. And we're being very honest, you see, the reason we don't have profits this year is because we have a very high code of ethics, and we can't descend to the level of our competition. The shareholders aren't interested in that. They want to know the bottom line. What are the profits? What's the bottom line? And we have to be very careful not to allow that to infiltrate into our Yiddishkeit and into our Ruchnis as well. Of course, results are also important. One needs to achieve results too. But the method of achieving the results, the process of achieving the results, is at least as important as the results themselves. The means of getting there is not only a means. The means of getting there is an end in itself. We have it, for example, in the learning of Torah. That's all part of the mitzvah of learning Torah, the greatest mitzvah that there is. Even when you're learning incorrectly, but that's part of the process of analyzing in order to get to the correct answer. We're not interested only in the result. We're interested in how that result was achieved. And that's why if you look at any great shalos and tshuvas, if you look at any of the great responsa, they're not just the bottom lines. And sometimes the bottom line is omitted, it's totally irrelevant. What's important is the reasoning which gets to the conclusion. That's what we work with, and that's what's essential. And so also in our avodah, also in our service of the Ribbono Shel Olam, not only the result is what's important, but also the getting there. Yitzchak needs to know that he is the product not of an instant metamorphic change which came over Avraham Avinu, and to totally discount the first 90 years of Sarah's life and the first 100 years of Avraham's life. Yitzchak has to know that he's a product of those 90 and those 100 years. He wasn't produced only in the moments before his conception. He was the product of all that struggle, of all that challenge, from the time, it's a full 90 and a full 100 years. What was Avraham doing during the first few years of his life? He was in a family of idolaters that also went to producing Yitzchak. The overcoming of that challenge, the overcoming, the mastery of that environment, the destruction of that environment, and the building of a new world around himself, all that which took 100 years, every moment of Avraham's life, went into the creation of Yitzchak, and is not the product only of his last little bit. That's terribly important, by the way, in people who become frum at later stages in their lives, or children of people who become frum in later stages of their lives. There is a tendency to block out what happened before. And that's not true, because the personality is a combination of everything that happened before, and he's mastering what happened before, and he's seeing through it, and he's overcoming it, and he's getting on top of it and rechanneling himself and redirecting himself. One mustn't look at one's history as if one started the day one became frum. One started the day one was born, one started centuries before one's born, one comes from a line, from a family, and all that goes into the product and the production of the individual which is afterwards born. And so the Ribbono Shel Olam names Yitzchak. You've got Yitzchak, the Yud, the tenth challenge is what you are. The eighth day of Milov, that's what you are. You're born with that. But don't think it came easy. It came easy to you. You were born with it. But it took 90 years of your mother's life and 100 years of your father's life to produce you. You're the product of centuries. You're not the product of a moment. That's what the name Yitzchak means. Now what's all that got to do with the laughter? The two kinds of laughter, one laughs in two different situations. The one time that one laughs is if something looks absurd, if something looks totally ridiculous. And if you analyze the jokes at which people laugh, you'll often find that there's a dimension of absurdity. It's ridiculous. You create a situation which is totally ridiculous and people laugh. The other kind of laughter is when something difficult and extremely challenging is suddenly resolved. There's a release of tension and one laughs. And that's a joyous laughter. The first laughter is a laughter of mockery, of absurdity. The second laughter is a laughter of joy, of discovery. So one laughs sometimes when one doesn't see the meaning, when things seem to have no meaning. One laughs, and sometimes one cries.
And laughter and crying are not that far from one another. When one is totally desperate and one can see absolutely no purpose and no meaning and no understanding in what is happening, it leads one either to a hysterical sort of laughing or to a crying, to tears. And the other tzchok is the laughter of chedvo, as Unkelus translates it, of joy and of happiness. If you look at the life of Avrom and the production of Yitzchak without the understanding, if you take out the yud and you take out the ches, if you take out the milo and you take out the akedah, you just look at the life. There's an old man, Avrom Avinu, old wife, desperately want to have children, can't. Hagar comes into the picture, Ishmael comes, doesn't bring his father an awful lot of nachas, and eventually he's 100 and she's 90 and they have a baby. That's weird. That's absolutely weird. It's not Zanin in 1987. That's it's Israel thousands of years ago. What, old people having children? It's totally weird. It has no meaning. It has no explanation. And one would laugh at that. One would mock. The laughter would almost be one of mockery. Although it's a wondrous thing, but it's so weird that one laughs. Sometimes if you see something very, very crazy, you see an unusual animal, a type of gorilla which is very unusual. In the Pretoria Zoo, they have some interesting specimens. And you look at them, you laugh. What are you laughing at? The most wonderful thing, and unbelievable, but you laugh. It's totally weird. But it's a product of nature, but you still laugh, because it's weird. And for Avrom and Sora to have a baby, that's weird. And that brings laughter. What kind of laughter? Mockery laughter, laughter of disbelief. And then there's the whole life, and Yitzchok is nurtured, and Yitzchok grows, and Avrom puts everything he's got into Yitzchok and teaches him all the Torah he knows. And then this old man starts becoming demented, so it would appear on the surface. He has this vision that this God of love and mercy, whom he's changed the whole world, on whose behalf he's changed the whole world, suddenly tells him to go and kill the son that he's born. Absurd. Totally absurd. It's something you would laugh about. Not laugh, but laugh in a sense of mockery. The old man's gone senile. And last minute he has another vision, luckily, which just saves, and you think, my goodness, poor Yitzchok. His life is in the hands of a man who's having visions. One day kill your son, one day don't kill your son. The prayer, how does he live? How does he survive? It's totally absurd. But if one sees it in the context of the Yud and the Ches as well, if one understands that this is not nature, this is supernature. Avrom and Sarah could have a child at that age because they had conquered nature, not because there's any natural explanation for it, not because it's scientifically explicable, but because Avrom and Sarah had reached a level where he's no longer the Av only of Aram. He's not working anymore with sound waves, he's working with electromagnetic waves. He's working with Kedusha, he's working on an elevated level where he masters science, not he is mastered by science. He masters nature, not he is mastered by nature. And it is necessary for him to have a Yoyresh, it is necessary for him to have a spiritual heir, so he needs a child. He's 100 years old and his wife is 90. So what? He's mastered nature. He doesn't have to submit himself to nature. Then one understands it all of a sudden. And then the tzchok comes one of admiration. Is it possible for a human being to reach such a level where he's able to master and manipulate nature entirely on behalf of the Ribbono Shel Olam? That brings one to a tzchok of wonderment. And so Yitzchok's name is made up of two different parts. There's the Ches and the Yud, which refers to the future, to Yitzchok's own experience, but that's the meaning of it all. There's the Kuf and the Tzadi, which is in the past, and that's the absurdity of it all. But when you join them together, and you see the future in the past, and you understand where it's all going, and you see the entire picture of who Yitzchok is in the link between Avrom and Yaakov, and you see the birth of the Jewish people in Yitzchok's name, then mockery and absurdity becomes wonderment and meaning. And the tzchok changes from one of mockery into one of joy and into one of happiness. Lastly, on the Akedah, the challenge which Avrom had to live through in sacrificing Yitzchok goes one step further. It's the challenge of the Av. Yitzchok is now, we have said, a creation not only by Avrom, but a creation from Avrom. Avrom is both the creator and the raw material from which the creation is made. That's what a child is. Parents, together with the Ribbono Shel Olam, but looking at the parents from their points of view, create a child out of themselves. So they are both the creator and the raw material for that act of creation. You remember some while ago we learned that wonderful Rabbeinu Tam, that the human being is the only being who can be subject and object simultaneously. The human being is the only being that can educate itself, that can operate on itself, that can instruct itself. It can be subject and object together. It's a little bit of the same concept, that the parent is the only creator who is also the raw material. It's the only case where the raw material creates itself, where there is self-creation. Now, we all know how attached we get to our creations, whether it's in the physical world, whether it's an artist who's painted a painting, or a sculptor who's sculpted a statue, whether it's an author who's written a book, whether it's somebody who's had an idea, and it's his own chidush, it's his own idea. We become exceptionally attached to our own creations. In fact, there's hardly anything that we are more attached to than we are to our own creations. And when it comes to a child, it's even more so. Now, not only are we attached to the child because the child is our creation, but the child is ourself as well. So the child has this unique relationship where one is in fact closer to one's child than one is to oneself. Because to myself, I'm not my creator, I'm only myself. To something I've created, I am its creator, but it's not me. But the child is both my creation and it's me. And Avraham is told, take your creation, which is yourself, and can you destroy it, if that is really necessary? Are you able to do it? And that's a precondition for Avodas Hashem. We must be able to do that. One has to be able to take a piece of Gemara and learn through it and have the most wonderful chidush and jump with joy at one's understanding and write it down and rework it and rewrite it and spend a lot of money publishing it. And as it's about to be distributed, somebody points out to you, but it's wrong. You're not aware of something. What you've said is wrong. One has to be able to say, if that's the case, destroy it. I told you the story, and you might have heard it directly. Rabbi Kay, the late Rabbi Kay, used to know the Shamus in Brisk, an old man when Rabbi Kay was a little boy, who used to write the notes for Reb Chaim. Reb Chaim used to dictate to him, Reb Chaim Brisker, and he used to write. And he told them how one day Reb Chaim came in and said, take out all the notes. He took out the pile, and he said, throw them out. Let's start again. They're wrong. That ability to take something which is one's own creation and to be able to destroy it because it's not emes, to be able to destroy it because it's not positive, it's not constructive, that is the precondition for the Jewish people. They need to have that middo. If one doesn't have that middo, it is not possible to live a life of emes. One can try to live a life of truth, but if one's own creations are more important to one than the truth, one cannot win. One cannot become supernatural. Then one can operate within nature. But one needs to be able to be supernatural, and to be able to be supernatural, one must be able to be willing to destroy not only one's creations, but also oneself. And not only oneself, but also one's creation. And also that which is both one's creation and oneself, if that's what is really necessary to do. That was the Nisoyon of Avraham. The only one of the ten where Avraham is being tried as father, as Av Hamoyen Goyim. I'm not testing you for your own life, to see what you do with your own life. But are you as a father willing to take your toldah? Are you willing to take that which you have created from within yourself and sacrifice that also to the Ribbono Shel Olam if that has to be done? And Avraham succeeds. That is the meaning of the name of Yitzchak. That being who is created, ready-made, with all the potential, not only to make any sacrifice that is needed for his beliefs, that there are many people who can do. That there are people who can do, even there are non-Jews who can do that. It is not something uniquely Jewish. It is not something uniquely Torah to be able to make sacrifices for your beliefs. But to even sacrifice your beliefs when that is necessary for emes, to be able to say, I'm wrong, to be able to say, I've made a mistake, to be able to say that everything I believe in is based on a faulty premise and I have to change it, to be able to do that, that's already supernatural, and that's one of the fundamental principles with which a Jew is born. That's the name of Yitzchak, a name which means the eighth day, the bris milah, the ability of taking nature and overpowering it, the tenth nisoyon, the ability to take one's own creations and dominate them, not be dominated by one's own creations, and the realization that that didn't come easily, that for that poor Avraham and Sarah had to struggle all their lives to be able to create one child, Yitzchok, who had that perfection, that potential to start the Jewish people on its way.